stay tuned for writers on writing on KUCI-FM in Irvine.
Expressed on this program do not necessarily represent those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other KUCI programs, visit kuci.org or kucitalk.org.
And hello, and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org and iTunes College Radio. Today is Wednesday, March 26, 2014. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guests today are novelists Jane Porter and Andrea Portes. First up is Jane Porter. She's the best-selling author of 45 romances and women's fiction titles and has been a finalist for the prestigious Rita Award 4 times. She has over 12 million copies in print. She wrote Flirting with 40, a novel picked by Red Book magazine, and as it is red hot, sorry, the lights just went off in here, so somehow I'm going to read this in the dark. They're coming back on. Great. Okay. Anyway, she wrote Flirting with 40, a novel picked by Red Book magazine as its red hot summer read in 2006, before being turned into a Lifetime movie in 2008 starring Heather Locklear. Jane holds an MA in writing from the University of San Francisco and makes her home in San Clemente, California. You can learn more about Jane at janeporter.com. Hi there.
Hi.
How are you?
I'm good.
Oh, just some technical glitches, but I think it's all straightened out. Anyway, let's start by, 40 books in print, or 45 books in print?
Yes.
I mean, that's, you look about 30. How are you so prolific here?
Because it's the only way I pay my bills, and I'm a single mom. I mean, I have to say I was for almost 9 years, and it's a job, and it's kind of a brutal thing to take your passion, and writing was always my passion. From the time I was little, I wrote stories, and all throughout grade school, and junior high, and high school. And so it's an interesting thing when you... I almost feel like a little bit of a brotherhood, I think, with, like, say, Hollywood writers or screenwriters or people who write day in, day out for a living. And you have a very fixed, like, focus. This is our goal. This is our outcome. This is where we're going. Because I used to be much more literary in my own writing. I wasn't always so commercially bent. But now it's like we have to meet deadlines. We have to pay bills. And so I've taken a passion and squeezed it into a professional gig.
Yeah. Did you think this all out when you were starting out? I mean, did you think, oh, you know, women's fiction or romance fiction is you know, the best-selling genre, and so that's what I'm going to do? Or was it part that and part what you read and what you saw? I mean, how did that happen?
I just knew in romance, especially when I started looking, giving it a kind of a hard look. I was already in college. I was early in college, but I was somewhat strategic in that where are they publishing consistently quite a few areas, and where could I fit? And I don't read or write sci-fi. I don't write thrillers, mysteries. So for me, I understood women's fiction or fiction. I grew up on the big 80s blockbusters, you know, Princess Daisy, and I also loved John Clavell, and I liked a big, fat, juicy read. And so I could see as a commercial writer, but also how often did they publish a single title? How did you break in? How would you become one of those who had a big New York Times spot? And it seemed far more daunting, you know, to a 20-year-old, because I was a UCLA sophomore, when I really began to study all the markets and how to do this. And I started submitting in college my sophomore year at UCLA. So instead of ever writing finals and essays, I was writing romances and query letters to publishers. So I think that what I realized was there's a place like Harlequin, Silhouette back then, Bantam Books, Bantam Love Swept. They all bought and published X number of titles a month. And it just seemed like there was more of a chance to get your foot in the door there than just, you know, one individual story. So I targeted that market.
Interesting. So then within that market, within that genre of women's fiction, I would imagine then there are maybe not a million subgenres, but a lot of them, and you have to somehow figure out where you fit, or do you write the book first and see where it fits?
Well, you know, what I love now with the internet is we can find out so much information so fast. Back then, you wanted writers or publishers, guidelines or tips. You had to write, you know, send in a self-addressed stamped envelope, wait for somebody to send you something back. If you were writing to a London publisher in Canada, it could take, you know, weeks, months. So I would try to write for guidelines, but in the meantime, I was writing a story at home thinking I'm going to give them something they don't have. But that could be the right word length, hopefully. That could be. And it wasn't until years later I realized, okay, with category romance, particularly, say, like a Harlequin, they don't necessarily want what they don't have. They want a new twist on what they have. So I spent years writing stories that they did not have, and it wasn't until I finally attended a conference and I heard them, all these editors, speak in person, and I was like, oh, okay. Because they don't ever quite come out in a rejection letter and say, we would never buy a senator, or we would never buy a Hollywood set story, or we would never buy Northern Ireland or Ireland. They would just say, this isn't quite right for us. And so it was interesting. Once I got all the missing pieces, I then, within a year and a half, started to sell. Because my writing chops had grown, I'd written all these rejected books. I'd gotten my MA. I started filling the craft pieces. But in that case, the market pieces were missing. In today's business and industry, I don't think there's any excuse for anyone to say they can't figure out the business. It's all up there on the internet. You know, everything's available on websites.
What about, today's business includes self-publishing. And what do you think? I mean, do you think if you were starting out today and you were having trouble getting a book published, and by trouble, I mean, you know, you tried maybe for a year, maybe two, to get an agent or get a publisher and it didn't work, would you self-publish? I mean, what do you think about that?
There have been writers who have had a lot of success. There was a very sweet spot in the market. It looked like in 2011, 2012, where people were doing just that. And if they had quite a bit of a backlist of rejected books, I think that those writers were savvy and they were gutsy and they knew how to market themselves and position themselves, and they found writers. I tend to still be what I call a writer's writer. I really believe in craft. I have no regrets. I actually didn't hold out. I was offered a number of contracts and offers from small publishers or startup publishers in those, you know, 10, 15 years before I got my first big sale to the London office of Harlequin. But in the end, I was targeting the biggest. I wanted to come out kind of with a bang, partly because I had a plan. Again, I wanted to go with one of these publishers. I was going to write like Jane Inkrentz or Nora Roberts, Tammy Hoag. You know, there was all the big New York Times, huge chunk of those, if not the majority of women, started in category romance. And they built a name and a following and their writing chops, and then they went to write single titles. So I thought, I will do that. I'll do 30 or 40, and then we'll, you know, move me out into single titles, and I'll take my Jane Porter name and brand and readers with me. I couldn't actually make it to 30 or 40. At book number 15 for Harlequin, I needed to start writing other kinds of stories as well. But I still believe, for me, working with editors, working with a marketing team, working in a business, is really good for writers. Because sometimes we can be a little bit indulgent and say, well, this is what the story is. But if you're not able to convey that story to the reader, if the reader doesn't get it or own it or love it, then you're just writing only for yourself. So I think I tend to think more of the reader sometimes than some other authors when they're starting out. It's really the reader's story in the end. You're giving it to them.
So true. So true. We can easily forget about the reader.
Well, and I think if you're writing a certain kind of story, you can say, you know, I'm going to write this for me, and this is kind of a genius thing, and I hope you get how clever I am, or how creative, or how beautiful my prose is. But that's not the backbone of commercial fiction. Commercial fiction, just that's not how it operates. You want the masses. You know, you need the numbers on your side, not the literary, you know, elite. And I'm very comfortable. I'm from a, you know, San Joaquin Valley, farm town. I didn't know writers growing up. I wasn't surrounded by a literary community. I was surrounded by amazing, solid, you know, ranchers and farming families and really good people. And I've loved that idea of just writing great stories for really good people.
You are listening to Writers on Writing. I am talking with Jane Porter. You know, you have, you know, with all these books, storylines, how do you come up with different storylines every time? Do you kind of plot out a book and go, okay, this one, the theme is, the main character is, the problem is, her quirks are? I mean, how do you go about it?
No, I wish I was this really analytical, linear person. I usually, when I'm writing one story, I start to feel pieces of other stories out there, but I'm actually not. It's not as easy for me to come up with story after story. I think that's almost why I've loved writing connected books and series and families, where, like my Brennan sisters, where we had three books, where you start with one knowing, okay, we're going to have two more books, but you let them just kind of grow, and you have a, you know, obviously when you're pitching this or selling it to your editor or your agent, and you've got to have a story down there. You have to have a synopsis, and you have to have a partial or some pages for them to read. But it's really why I'm in the middle of writing. It goes from being a caricature to a real character, to somebody that I'm not pulling strings as a puppeteer, but that the reader finds that the character owns this life and that they're very invested. And that, for me, only happens in the writing. So I waste a lot of time digging around in a book and messing around there until I'm like, aha, here really is the story. It's not what just the surface thing here, but it's all this. So I throw away probably 200-400 pages every book, which I hate. But
does that happen after the book's written, or as you're going through it and you start and you're on page 50 and you go, this is the start. It wasn't page one. This is the start.
Usually my start will come around after, like you say, 50, 100, even 150 pages, and I'm like, this is the start. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I just have to do that for me as the writer. And it's not that some of that information can't be woven in other places, but I like to open a book, especially the women's fiction, at the most crucial turning point. I don't want to, like, give them two chapters of the ordinary world, and then now we have our turning point. I do recognize that a lot of my readers have a lot of competing things to grab their attention. You know, there's TV and kids and, you know, bills. There's all kinds of things. So I really believe hook them hard early and then keep keep them hooked. I mean, don't give them a chance to put that book down and go to bed and not pick it up again.
Mm. And that would go with whatever genre you're writing in. I mean, whether you're writing literary fiction or suspense or women's or romance, whatever. I mean, it's like hook them early.
I do. I like that. I love, I use dialogue a lot as a hook. I think because, again, when I went to UCLA, I went as theater arts in the beginning, and I grew up doing a lot of theater and Shakespeare. And, you know, Shakespeare is all about these great lines, I think. And so I do love dialogue. That's where I often find and hear my characters when they're talking. I can hear them in my head so clearly. So dialogue for me is often a way I open. But there's amazing writers out there who use just an amazing one single opening line, and you're like, wow, that got me. Or they just have something else. I think every writer should know his or her strengths and then just work it from there. I admire so many writers, but I can't write like them. I'm only going to write like me. So I need to work my strengths, and hopefully, you know, you can hide your weaknesses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good point. Well, a while back I asked you for a few titles of your favorite books of your own, and one that you mentioned was Mrs. Perfect. And so I read it, and I liked it, and I found it really interesting in so many ways. But there were a few funny things, and I wanted to ask you how much you will bring your own life into your books. Because this one thing, I think your narrator's book group was reading the memoir The Glass Castle, and your protagonist couldn't stand the book. I don't know if you remember that.
Yes, I do.
They've written so many books. But I was just so curious about that because, you know, I won't say I couldn't stand the book, but I haven't loved it as much as others have loved it. And so, you know, why do you pull in things like that? And
I think there's a lot of my women's fiction, I really would love it to have been set, not like in this quiet other women's fiction world that's, again, a little more perhaps literary, but I love that feeling that you can be climb into a suburban neighborhood and this is where your story is set, and they're the real moms around you. They're the real, whether it's PTA or it's that real community of women who are raising kids and, you know, had one certain idea of what life would be like, and they're dealing with this real life. And so being an author, you do a lot of book clubs and book club call-ins, and you always hear, oh, you're our light read. You're our summer read. We read really good books. And then I always thought it was so funny. People would be very apologetic, like, well, I hope it's okay. We wanted a light read, and we chose you. And I said, that's fantastic. And then a couple women inevitably make a point that they don't like that kind of thing. They really read good books. And then someone always whispers, I really don't like some of our reads. They're really depressing. And it just happened that someone at one book club had said, I couldn't read that book. And what did you think? I said, well, I found it hard too. But it's these moments of vulnerability that real mm-hmm. women will often show or share that I think that's sometimes you're afraid to. I love those. I guess that's it. It's that, do we have to always be smart and together? Do we always have to be that kind of glossy, fierce woman? Are we allowed to be cracked and flawed and just as lovable? And that tends to run through almost all of my books. And I don't ever have an answer. I just like to kind of stir the pot and see what happens.
Mm-hmm. No, it's fun. I mean, as I was reading that, I could feel the fun that you had writing it. And, you know, certain other things jumped out that I wondered, you know, is Eva Zinsser, is that her name because Jane is paying homage to William Zinsser?
Oh, I love it. No one else has gotten that. Absolutely, yes. I was sitting there one day writing, and I turned to the left where I keep my favorite writing books. In fact, Barbara, yours is one on my shelf next to four or five others. But I didn't realize that was you until recently. I'm like, oh my gosh, there's the book. But yes, it was William Zinsser.
Oh, cool.
So if you find a DeMarco in one of my books, you know I was sitting there one day going, I need a name, and boom, there it is.
Well, that's the fun thing with fiction, I think, is that you can pull in things that have happened to you or have happened to friends, of course, disguised if they happen to friends, and if they happen to you, I suppose, but that you can mix it up. And I think that, I mean, that's just sort of the never-ending joy of writing fiction.
Well, I think what's, you know, it's one of those things where we as writers make a choice. I could write a lot of nonfiction memoir. I've lived through some incredibly brutal, bad things, and I just find, like, even just saying that, my chest gets really tight, and it's scary. And I think not because it wasn't real, but it becomes more horrific. I can't change what really was. But if you pull it into fiction, and me just telling it is not cathartic for me, just sharing that and putting it out there bald is not healing in any way. I don't want people to go, oh, wow, she had to go through that. I don't want that. I don't really. But what I do want is to see something that is that frightening or dark or oppressive, and reframing it, and that there's, you know, this other hope at the end. There's this other place that somebody is safer and stronger and better. I just can't write a story of beautiful brokenness, because to me, emotionally, it's still too horrifying, because it is real and happens to people everywhere. And there's nothing vicariously thrilling in that for me, but taking something that is raw and brutal and then reframing and shaping through fiction, I think, is empowering. I think that's really probably why I write what I write. I grew up being kind of Anne Sexton, Sylvia Plath, and very dark and very tortured. And then there's this one point I thought, if I become a mom, I do not want to leave a legacy of literary pain. I don't want to be a Hemingway. I don't want to end sadly or badly. My father was a writer and a professor, and I don't want, no offense to him, I don't want to be his daughter as a mom. Mm-hmm. And I chose, if I write, then I'm going to write fiction that makes people feel good, and I'm going to feel good, and I'm going to be as strong and healthy and empowering as a creative woman. And so I will never be anybody's literary darling, but I have my own little, sounds funny, my own little path and mission to let people know that words and stories can be very redemptive.
And I would imagine, too, that, you know, I'm sure you're many readers and writers' darling, actually, because the reader, the romance and the women's fiction community, it reminds me a little bit of the mystery and suspense readers community, that there's this sort of like subculture, you know, there are all these people that come out to events, whereas, you know, the literary community, where is everybody? Are they all in Brooklyn? You know, are they all in Iowa? Where are they? You know, but readers for women's fiction and for suspense and mystery come out in droves.
They do. Every reader has her secret, like, love, I think, too, or her loves. You know, her glam read or her escape read. I do. I read Regencies. I love Georgette Heyer, you know, desperately, passionately. Is it Ava Ibotson, who wrote some incredible, you know, not just YA books, but these historicals that I adored. And then I love just some of the classic Regency-style romances today, where there's a beautiful world and there's situations and problems, but I know no one is going to be axe-murdered, nobody is going to be locked up and tortured, no children are hurt, no puppies are hurt, and you'd think, well, don't you know the outcome? But yes, I do, which is why I can relax and enjoy the prose and the voice and the wit. But I have a very big need to, you know, if I'm going to let my guard down and relax, to feel safe for a while. Now, someone else may not need that experience, and they may thrill on the danger and the, you know, the up and down and the heart racing. And I think that's what our job as writers is, isn't to be false, but be true to yourself and write the stories, and you will find readers for your stories.
Hmm. Are you writing one book at a time, or are you sort of, I don't know, having another idea in the back of your head as you're working on one?
I always start cooking my, sounds funny, the ideas start growing as I'm working on a book. Even if I don't want to, that's when they come. And I think it's because it's almost like when you're walking or you're running, you can start getting ideas then. It seems like once you're focused on one thing, it frees up a different part of your brain to start being creative. That the stress of, you know, lifting weights in that moment of writing the book, because it is a very stressful thing when you're making a choice. You know, writing is such a series of choices, one after the other after the other. And it's very disciplined in those moments of choosing the right decision and the right choice of words. And it's funny how that act, all of a sudden, another part of my brain is rebelling, going, but what about, and what if this, and oh, oh, oh. And usually by the time I finished a book, especially if it's a very demanding book, I have some other ideas, and I have books starting to grow. And so I often start growing a book in my head and making notes and starting the research a year out before I start a book. I need that much time, 6 months to a year. So I'll be starting to think of 2-3 different books for the future, and then I get to writing, and it works that way because I think it takes me that long to world build.
Mm. It's been great talking with you, and we are coming to the end of our time. Will you offer a few words of advice for the writers who are maybe battling a novel or trying to get through something and perhaps running into roadblocks?
Well, first thing I'm going to say, it is really hard, and I think writing is really hard, and so that's an accomplishment, and pat yourself on the back. So if it is frustrating, know that it's frustrating for all of us as writers. You're not alone. And don't give up. I mean, just know that the only way to the end is through it, and you will get there. And to have faith in yourself, and don't ever lose the pleasure in writing. And protect that creative part of you.
Mm. Thank you so much. I hope you'll come back on again another time.
Absolutely, Barbara. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Jane. That was Jane Porter. More at janeporter.com. Stay tuned for our next guest. We'll be right back.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI FM in Irvine. We are talking to you from the UC Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and in the first half, I was with Jane Porter, and I am back with Andrea Portes. Andrea is the best-selling novelist of the critically lauded novel Hick, and the book was her debut novel, was made into a feature film, which she wrote. Her new book, Bury This, came out in February of this year, and it examines the 1979 murder of a young woman and its effect on a small town in Michigan. Andrea grew up shuffled around between such disparate locales as Nebraska, Brasilia, Texas, Rio de Janeiro, Baltimore, North Dakota, California, Wisconsin, and North Carolina. And finally, she was granted relief from this nomadic existence when she was accepted into Bryn Mawr College, where she attended on full scholarship and later graduated cum laude with a major in English literature. She then earned her master's in fine arts from UC San Diego. Let's bring her on. Andrea, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good to have you back on. You were on with Hick, and you're back with Bury This, and I would love it if you would just talk a little bit about how the story of this girl and this murder found its way to your desk.
Well, it's interesting. I had thought after writing Hick that I would write something that was sort of a very East Coast novel, just to kind of tip my hat to my time at Bryn Mawr, and for some reason, it just wasn't really working. And one night, I was at home and I saw this story on the news about one of these cold case shows about this issue, and I became completely fascinated, obsessed, and horrified by the story. I mean, it was so awful what had happened that I really couldn't wrap my brain around it, and so I had such a visceral reaction to it and such a sense of injustice that I sort of just had to write the book because it was a way of sort of exercising those demons.
How much did you know before you began, or before you realized that the idea had traction for you and that it would be a book and not a short story or not an article or an essay or something else?
Well, it's interesting. I always sort of knew it would be a novel just because I write in novel form, I mean, I was telling a friend of mine who wanted me to write a screenplay that it's easier for me to write a novel than it is to write a screenplay or a treatment or an article. I mean, the form of the novel really works for me. I really understand it in a way that I don't other things. And this kind of just sort of, I would write, in the morning about three chapters a day, longhand, and then I'd go, and then after I got through the first draft, then I actually put it in the computer.
Hmm. Interesting. Are you a disciplined writer? I mean, do you, you know what you're going to do when you sit down and you just, even if you don't, you stay there and you just get something down?
No, I'm not. It's interesting. Sometimes I'm amazing, or I'm not amazing, but I'm saying sometimes the process is amazing, and I can get down, 7,000 words in one sitting. And sometimes there's just nothing there. And I probably should sit down more and try to write. But for me, it's just it's a combination. It just depends on what day it is. Sometimes I'm the most disciplined writer you would ever know, and then other days I'm just the biggest slacker you could ever imagine. I mean, it really just depends on what is going on in my head at the moment,
Well, Hick, I loved Hick, and it seems like it was such a different book, not in writing style or voice so much as, I would imagine it was, it wasn't based on a true story. You may have lived some of it. I have no idea, or have lived in locales that Hick took place in. But maybe talk about the difference between writing a novel that is, that can be totally made up versus writing a novel based on a true story.
Well, I mean, I basically used, in both cases, I mean, Hick was semi-autobiographical, not exactly, you know what I mean? Like, I think it was probably, to be quite honest, would be semi-autobiographical. and this too, you know, the architecture was there. I knew what the story was, but I made the characters up out of whole cloth, and I made, you know, so the nice thing was I knew where I was going, but I also didn't always, you know how I was getting there. I felt that the process was a lot easier than it was with Hick, because Hick, I took for so long writing that book because it was my first book, and I wasn't published. I didn't think of myself as a writer, so it was a very sort of lackadaisical process. Whereas with Bury This, I was pregnant with my son Wyatt, and I didn't have that much to do, and so I basically wrote it in those 9 months.
I am speaking with Andrea Portes. Her new book is Bury This, and it's published by Soft Skull Press, which is a division or an imprint of Counterpoint. So then, you know, talk about voice, because I noticed on the back of Bury This, Publishers Weekly said about it, Portes's short chapters and staccato narration make for a quick and compulsive read. As a study in human nature, it's a triumph. Talk about that. Talk about getting the voice down and those short chapters and staccato narration.
It was really strange writing this book. I mean, I really would just sort of sit down and get quiet and start to listen, and then the voice, you know, would sort of come to me, and I would just sort of write what was coming to me, and it was so obvious when it was done. So, you know, sometimes I'd sit down to write something that was a long chapter, and it would end up being one of these two-page chapters, and then other times I would sit down to write something that seemed like it was going to be very quick, and then it ended up being, you know, a 10-page chapter. So it was basically the writing, I was just sort of following along with what was kind of coming, whatever, you know, creatively to me. And it wasn't a very forced process. I mean, I didn't sit there and say, okay, this is going to be staccato, or this is going to be, you know, a really short chapter. I kind of just let the story tell itself, and it was very obvious, you know, when that the chapter was done, or when the character had said what they wanted to say.
Because it was a true story that you were basing the book on, I would imagine you had an end point, or you knew how it was going to end. Is that so?
Not exactly. I mean, I sort of, and this happened with Hick also, and it also happened with my next book that's coming out in September, Anatomy of a Misfit. I have an ending, and then I usually end up with a different ending. I'll have an ending, and, you know, somewhere along the line it will kind of cross my mind that ending isn't landing. And it's such a, you know, I mean, it's kind of a thing for me is, you know, sort of the hook at the beginning of a story and the landing at the end. You know, you really have to land it. I feel like, you know, there are so many things, whether it's a movie or a book, that I'll read, and, you know, and it could be just beautiful, but if you don't land it, it sort of leaves you with a feeling of, ugh, why did I just do that? But so this actually ended a little bit earlier, and then I went back about a year later and added the last chapter.
Interesting. Okay. Yeah, I think perhaps one of the myths readers have about novels based on true stories is that, you know, they follow exactly what happened, the way it happened. They don't make anything up. You know, it's the characters are all, you know, exactly as the characters would be. I mean, how can you know everything in writing, even writing a book based on a true story?
Well, I mean, the good thing is I made everything up. I mean, I took the sort of, it was inspired by the true story, but I basically just took it and ran with it in terms of the characters and all of that. And so that way I allowed myself a lot of freedom. I mean, I did research about Michigan. I've never been to Michigan, so my research was all on Google. And it was so much fun because I would just sort of go on there and say, oh, what do they do there? Oh, ice fishing. What are they fishing? Perch. Oh, you know, and it was, you know, kind of like going into this amazing world. But the fact of the matter is, like, I don't think I could write something that was, you know, very strictly, you know, sticking to the story, because, you know, I need my characters to be able to sort of do what they're going to do.
Mm. Yes, you do. They do have to do what they're going to do, no matter what you think they should do. I'd love to hear you read. Will you read to us?
Sure, yeah. I'll read this bit from the prologue and then something from inside, and hopefully this will be good. Okay, so this is the prologue, a.k.a. in script terms, the page 2, the hook. It would be lily white, the snow, on a strange sort of day where the earth and the sky were the same shade of gray. How funny, he thought later, that in this moment the thought rumbling through his head had been annoyance with his wife for wasting so much money on those stupid dolls, a doll collection, collectibles. He told his friends he would eat his face off if any of those things were ever worth millions someday or going to be worth a fortune, as his wife pled, pondered, prayed. It was the last thought he would have before he would become forever the snowplower, or better yet, the snowplower who found her. Make these branches coal, grabbing down from the sky. What are they eager to clutch? Make these snowprints hurried and rushed. What are they eager to hush? There he goes, following them. Now it's a path, a scurry, a brush. Probably nothing, but might as well. Into the woods and the grabby, grabby trees, greedily waiting to pluck. A doll collection. What a hoot. How gaping and stupid, degrading it was. To think of that time, what, now 20 years ago, when he had looked into his bride's eyes under that veil on that altar and said the words, I do. If only he'd known about the doll collection, just one doll, things might have been different. Just one doll is what's there in the snow, in the clutter, in the shutter of light, stab, stab, stab through the trees. Just one doll, there it is, but there are porcelain fingers and ceramic toes and glass twinkly eyes unblinking, unblinking. It is, in fact, a girl, not a doll at all.
Hmm.
Okay. So that's the prologue, mm-hmm. And then I'm going to read just a little bit from 25 years later when they're at the graveyard.
Great. It'll
be pretty quick. The white laid out over the sloping hill, the sun just above the horizon and a yellow glow glare. Never gold on a freeze-black tree, silent morning like this. 15 below wind chill on the tombstone sticking out of the milk sprawl ground, sporadic. No grid here, as random the plots as the snow around them. Some trodden, lots of visitors. Some bare as an ice rink, no visitors, long dead. What did you make of it? Does it matter now? What did you collect? Anything good? Is it with you now? Some buried in great grand family orchestrations with giant granite obelisks. Fisher, Macon, Collins. We were in it together. We were a family. We meant something. Once. Some just the two of them, husband and wife. We stayed true. We fall and rise as one. Then also the lone gravestones with nothing around, no prints. Nothing but the scraped black trees and the shadows drawing long in rectangles for companionship. What did it mean, any of it? What did I do wrong to end up alone and snow print less here? Or do we all end up alone, really? Then, the angel field near the gate, reserved for toddlers, infants, and children. The ground crying, too, don't fill me. Don't fill me with that. And all beneath the pale oatmeal sky with streaks of silver, streams of yellow-white strands masking sunrise. Wake up! But no one will wake up here. A stubborn lot. The granite making stretched square shadows down the snowfield. Limitless silence. 1,000 questions to each stone square. No answer.
Hmm. Thank you so much. That was Andrea Portes reading from Bury This. Curious about the prologue, and I was, as you were reading it, I was wondering if, because I know prologues often come after the book is written when the author needs to find a way into the story and maybe needs to talk about something that happened after, you know, but it needs to come first. At what point did the prologue come?
It came first. I mean, it was chapter one for a really long time. I mean, it really just sort of the whole book came in chronological order, you know. So, but one thing that happened is when I gave it to my editor, he said, you know, this is just a little bit different in terms tonally from the rest of the book. Not completely in an insane way, but just a little bit. And he said, I think this should be the prologue. And I thought, oh, that's great. That's brilliant. I mean, it was, you know, one of those moments where you thank God you have an editor.
And you have a wonderful editor. Dan Smetanka is just great, a great person. How was it to work with, not necessarily him per se, but with an editor in terms of handing over your work, and how much change had to happen? I mean, what happened then?
Well, it was actually kind of great. I mean, he, you know, the novel sort of is what it is, and he just came in there and sort of, you know, did some fine tuning, and you know, we took some things out. You know, we took a couple of chapters out, a couple of paragraphs out, and we put some things in. You know, we added some things here and there, and basically, you know, he had a really nice touch with the book. I mean, you stare at these things long enough, and you're so close to it, you can't really see it anymore. And so, it's really nice to have an editor that you trust that kind of, you know, can bring it up, you know, can bring the book to the next level, which he absolutely did. And I feel so, I mean, I also felt that way with Fred Ramey, with Hick at Unbridled Press. Like, I felt that I was very lucky to have someone that, you know, that I trust to do that. And, you know, I have that also with my new editor at HarperCollins. It's great because, you know, when you have a kind of faith now, like I have a kind of faith now when I'm writing, you know, even if I'm, you know, thinking in the back of my mind, oh, this is garbage, or I'm not sure if this is works. I know that I have somebody there who will say, oh, yeah, no, that works, or, oh, no, that doesn't. And that actually facilitates the process.
Do you pass your work to early readers, to a writer's group, or to a writing buddy or someone?
No, I don't. I write it, you know, like I said, I write longhand, and then I put it in the computer, and then I do an edit. So there's basically two edits, the one that goes, you know, from the longhand into the computer, and then another one. And then I'll give it to, you know, my agent. They'll give me notes, and then we'll take it out. But I don't like doing things by committee, you know, and so I just feel like I like one person telling me what to do, so the editor, you know. But if it's too many people, I think it tends to get sort of confusing.
Mm-hmm. What about when you're in a place or in a chapter, in a scene, and you just don't know where to go with it? Do you stay at the desk? Do you go do something completely different? Do you pick up a book and start reading? What do you do? I mean, how do you write yourself out of something that either isn't working or isn't coming?
If I'm in the mode and it's just not working, and it's just, you know, if I'm writing and it's just not coming, I'll leave it and I'll go do something really weird. Usually I like to sort of take myself on what they call, you know, sort of artist dates. So usually if something like that happens, I'll just go and do something else. Usually something sort of weird, you know, like go down to Chinatown by myself or something like that, to just kind of get out of my head. And usually what happens then is the problem, whatever it is, it's there, you know, it's sort of stewing, but I'm not really focusing on it. It's there. And then usually within, you know, a day or two, the solution will reveal itself. And then I'll, you know, I'll wake up, you know, the next morning or two mornings later and say, ah, okay, this is how to do this.
Interesting. So you won't write out of order?
Not for the first draft. No, mm-hmm. The first draft I really bear down and then go all the way through the first draft, knowing that it's, you know, thinking to myself, you know, this is garbage, it's going to be garbage, it's the first draft, but just, you know, basically reaching the finish line just to know what the basic architecture is.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, once I do that, then I leave it for about 2 weeks, and then I'll go and read it. And, you know, and some of the things I think, oh, God, this is horrible. And then some things I think, oh, this isn't so bad. And then, you know, and then I'll kind of go in and start fine-tuning.
You'll read it in longhand before you put it on the computer?
No, I'll read it on the computer.
Talk about writing longhand and doing a whole first draft that way.
It's a weird thing. I mean, there's something very, I don't know. I mean, it's kind of a process that it's almost medicinal in a way. I mean, I feel like when I'm writing literary fiction, it's just the process of writing longhand, there's a kind of release to it. You know, I write really fast and just, you know, and no one could ever understand what it looks like. I mean, no one could ever read it except for me. And I just sort of like, it's like this fever dream, and then I finish it, and then, you know, and then I'll go and you know, do some more. So sometimes it'll be three chapters. And afterwards, I'm usually pretty exhausted, I mean, honestly. But it's almost like this impetus, this thing that has to happen, and then it's sort of happens, you know, kind of like get this thing out, exercise this thing, and then, you know, and then there's sort of like a release. And I don't like to do it every day. I do it pretty much every other day because it's sort of exhausting, and also I find that the ideas are better if I take a day in between.
Interesting. We are at the end of our time, and I wonder if you have any advice for the writers listening. Maybe advice that you received along the way that stuck with you and has been helpful ever since?
I think my advice is don't be too hard on yourself. I think a lot of writers, you know, people that are aspiring writers, they have an idea and then they sit down and they'll start to write and then they'll think, oh, this is garbage, and then they won't do it for about 6 months or maybe ever again. And I think that if you just give yourself the sort of leeway to say, yeah, first draft is going to be garbage, but I'm going to write it because there's something I want to say, then, you know, the process of writing whatever, you know, at 200 pages in, you know, at some point a voice will come to you. The voice will start to come. And you know, it's practice. You're not going to start writing your first novel and be, you know, whoever, Joyce Carol Oates from the very beginning. You know, your voice is something that you have to find. So if that's your aspiration, don't sit down and write, you know, your first page and think this is garbage and then never write again.
Are you going to be at the LA Times Festival of Books in April?
I'm not sure. I think there are leanings towards that, but I think I'm still sort of waiting to hear if that's going to be happening.
Well, you would be perfect on a panel I'm moderating called, I forget what it's called, Fiction, History into Fiction or whatever, but novels based on true stories. Got to get you on that panel.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
That
well, you
perfect.
Know, talk to Dan about it. That would be great. I'd love to.
Well, thank you so much, Andrea, for taking the time.
Thank you so much for having me.
You're welcome. That was Andrea Portes. Her new novel is Bury This, published by Counterpoint. As regards the LA Times Festival of Books, it's the second week of April. You can find out more by going to their website. My panel is on Sunday, I think at noon. I don't even remember. But it's a fiction panel with excellent authors. And this coming Saturday is Ladies of Intrigue. Put on by Sisters in Crime, which you can find out by going to the Sisters in Crime website, ocsistersincrime.org. I am going to this. There's some great panels, one on creating character, another on plotting, all stuff that we need to hear over and over again from different points of view. And then the following weekend is Literary Orange that takes place here in Irvine. You can go to their website, literaryorange.com or .org. And it's, I think the Orange County Library Association is putting on that. That one, I'm doing a memoir panel at some point. And Marie Stone, who's a co-host here on Writers on Writing, is doing a fiction panel. That's all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for listening to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. See you next time.